Shalom, everybody, and we welcome you to this week's five-minute update, where we look at the news from the past week as it relates to major Bible prophecy of the end of days, where we focus on the prophecy of dividing the land of Israel, Joel chapter 3, verse 2, in the city of Jerusalem, Zechariah in chapter 14, and verse 2, which will result in the judgment of the nations, Zechariah chapter 14 and verse 3. And in the judgment of the nations, there's two primary elements to it. That is war between the nations and worldwide economic collapse. From the war between the nations and worldwide economic collapse, there will come about one world government, one world currency, which is the fulfillment of Revelation in chapter 13. And so we're called to be watchmen on the walls, Isaiah chapter 62. And in doing so, we are looking at current events and seeing how they are related to these prophecies and just possibly how close we are to their fulfillment. And our primary focus is looking at the current situation with the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. So I'd like to give you an update on that and my analysis of perhaps what may be the situation. Let's review for a moment that May 9th was the beginning day of what was agreed upon to be 4 months of indirect talks. Of course, those 4 months would end on September the 9th. And in getting the Palestinians to agree to these 4 months of indirect talks in conjunction with the Arab League, President Obama made promises to the Palestinians that at the end of this process, that he would do everything in his power to help to create a Palestinian state. And I believe it was the president's plan and motive to get Israel and the Palestinians to engage in direct talks. And then if the direct talks fail, then the United States was prepared to blame Israel. And ultimately, if Israel refuses to agree on the borders of a Palestinian state, they would go to the UN Security Council, where a Palestinian state in the borders would be recognized by the Security Council. I believe that was the plan that Obama had at the beginning of this four-month process. So now we are 3 months into the process of the indirect talk time frame, and I believe this is the reason why the United States wants to go to direct talks. And so the pressure in the last week or so is to get the sides to agree to these direct talks, and for the reason I believe the Obama is wants to use them to establish a Palestinian state. However, what we're going to see in the update is Mahmoud Abbas is being very stubborn and even agreeing to direct talks, even though I believe that it is the desire of the Obama administration to actually force an agreement. In the Middle East, in the Eastern mindset, there isn't such thing as compromise. It's I'm right and you're wrong, and I don't care how bad you look as long as I'm right. And so Mahmoud Abbas, in that Eastern pride, even though it would be, I believe, to his advantage to go into direct talks, he is refusing and putting forth conditions that he's had for several months. And that is, he wants first to there be an agreement that the direct talks, a written agreement, that the direct talks would be based upon 67 borders, and Israel would no longer build in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. So that is what we are going to see from these articles. So even though I believe Barack Obama is on the side of the Palestinians because Mahmoud Abbas is being stubborn. Several weeks ago, in the middle of July, Barack Obama wrote a letter to the Palestinians, in essence demanding them to go into direct talks or there would be consequences to the relationship with the United States. And once again, I don't believe the reason why Obama did this was because he's against the Palestinians. He's actually for the Palestinians, but it has to be done in such a way that he doesn't look like he is strong-arming the peace process and imposing a situation on Israel that cannot logically be defended, especially as we're having midterm elections in November. So I want to read this article first from the Sunday London Telegraph. The headline is, President Barack Obama delivers warning to Mahmoud Abbas on direct talks. Subheadline, Barack Obama has threatened to downgrade Washington's relationship with the Palestinian Authority unless it agrees to join direct peace talks with Israel within weeks. The article reads, after months of placing the onus on Israel to lay the groundwork for new negotiations, Mr. Obama's decision to change tack represents a desperate bid to salvage the long-stalled peace process from total collapse. In a letter delivered to Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian leader, 2 weeks ago, the U.S. president said he expected objections to direct talks to be dropped by early August, according to a version leaked to the pan-Arab newspaper Al Hayat. According to the 16-point missive, Mr. Obama's compliance would lead to renewed American support for Palestinian statehood, while resistance would result in painful consequences. Obama will regard any rejection of his proposal to move to direct talks as absolutely unacceptable, the letter read. Such rejection will have consequences in the form of a loss of trust in President Abbas and the Palestinian side. There will also be other effects on U.S.-Palestinian relations. So even though at surface it appears as though Obama is playing hardball with the Palestinians, it's only so he can get direct talk so he can play hardball with Israel, in my opinion, in my analysis from looking at things for the past 3-4 months. Now, the response by Mahmoud Abbas, this is from Reuters of Canada. The headline reads, Abbas resists U.S. pressure for direct talks. This article is August the 2nd. The Palestinian president told a visiting U.S. official Monday that Israel must commit to clear terms of reference for peace talks before the start of direct negotiations, Palestinian officials said. President Barack Obama's administration is putting pressure on Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas to agree to direct talks, which Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said he is ready to begin immediately. U.S. official David Hale, a deputy to Obama's Middle East envoy George Mitchell, had asked Abbas when direct talks could begin, said members of the Palestinian Liberation Organization Executive Committee briefed by Abbas. Mitchell has conducted 5 rounds of indirect talks between Abbas and Netanyahu since May. Obama has said he wants direct talks to begin by September. The president answered Hale that we, in principle, are not going against direct negotiations, Saleh Rafat, an executive committee member, said. However, we should hear from the Israelis the terms of reference for the negotiations and a halt to settlement activities. Netanyahu has said the Palestinians can bring all issues to the table and accuses Abbas of wasting time. The Palestinians aim to found their state in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip with East Jerusalem as its capital. Israel occupied the territories in a 1967 war. And this is another article regarding the response by Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinians. And one thing I need to mention is that a week or two ago, the Arab League approved direct talks with Israel, but they said it would be based upon the timing of which Mahmoud Abbas would like those direct talks to be held. So Mahmoud Abbas is stubbornly holding to his position. As this article explains, Abbas rejects U.S. request to set date for direct talks without reference. August the 2nd. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas on Monday rejected a U.S. request to set a date for moving to the direct peace negotiations with Israel without defining an international peace reference to it, a senior Palestinian official said. Wazel Abu Youssef, a senior Palestinian Liberation Organization official, told Xinhua that David Hale, deputy of U.S. peace envoy George Mitchell, asked President Mahmoud Abbas during their meeting earlier on Monday in Ramallah about setting a date for launching the direct talks. President Abbas informed Hale that he rejects setting any dates or appointments and reaffirmed the Palestinian position that settlement must be halted and a peace preference has to be defined before moving to direct negotiations. And now from Haaretz, this article is August the 5th. Abbas sets conditions for direct talks with Israel. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas said he was ready for direct negotiations with Israel, provided key conditions are met, including a total halt to settlement building in the West Bank, according to statements released Thursday. After months of U.S. brokered indirect meetings or proximity talks, Abbas said he would negotiate directly with Israel if the goal was to establish an independent Palestinian state on the territory occupied in the 1967 war. Abbas's statements came after a meeting with Saudi Arabia King Abdullah in Jeddah late Wednesday. From Haaretz, August the 2nd, Abbas wants a trilateral meeting between aides before direct talks. The Obama administration is attempting to win Israel's agreement to a Palestinian effort to hold a trilateral meeting next week to set the terms of reference, agenda, and timetable for direct negotiations with the Palestinians. The Palestinians also want to discuss the future of Israel's freeze on settlement construction, which is scheduled to expire on September the 26th. If Israel agrees to the meeting, it will be the first significant direct talks with the Palestinian Authority since Benjamin Netanyahu became prime minister last year. The talks might start in mid-August, Netanyahu told his Likud ministers on Sunday. It's not assured yet, and it will become clear in the next few days. Meanwhile, the Saudis are trying to get the Palestinians to enter into direct talks. From the Jerusalem Post, August the 6th. Saudi Arabia is urging Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas to enter direct talks with Israel and can sweeten a deal by offering financial assistance for agreeing to negotiations, a top Israeli diplomat said on Thursday. According to the official, the U.S., which is pressuring Abbas to enter the talks, was behind a meeting in Riyadh on Wednesday between Abbas and Saudi Arabia's King Abdullah. So the situation is, regarding the peace process, that the Arab League has approved direct talks with Israel based upon Mahmoud Abbas's stating his timing to enter into them. Mahmoud Abbas is still holding to his position that there must be an agreement before the talks regarding how the talks are going to come out. This is difficult for the United States to defend, dictating terms before the direct negotiations. And so this is why the United States is trying to get the direct talks so that then the terms can be dictated. And Shimon Peres of Israel has made this famous remark over the years: the Palestinians never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. And this is a big opportunity that they could really take advantage of. And so we'll see how it comes out. But one thing that hasn't got a whole lot of press that is very significant, and this is from Haaretz, and this article explains that several weeks ago, the Palestinians have made a peace offer to Israel. And because there isn't direct talks, Israel hasn't responded to the peace offer. But this is the first time the Palestinians have ever made a peace offer. As you know, Israel made a peace offer in 2000, Camp David, with Ehud Barak. And in 2008, Ehud Olmert made a peace offer to the Palestinians. So this is really significant that the Palestinians now have made their own peace offer. That if somehow they could get the direct talks, then this can be discussed. So the headline is, Arakat says to Haaretz that the Palestinian peace proposal is more generous than the deal that the Palestinians were offering Ehud Olmert in 2008. The Palestinian Authority has submitted a far-reaching peace proposal to the Obama administration that is more generous to Israel than the demands presented by Mahmoud Abbas to former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, the chief Palestinian negotiator told Haaretz on Saturday. Saab Arakat also said the Palestinians' detailed offer would end the conflict with Israel and resolve all Palestinian claims. I presented Senator George Mitchell with a series of official documents, Arakat said, referring to the special U.S. envoy to the Middle East. We gave him maps and papers that clearly state our position on all the final status issues, borders, Jerusalem, refugees, water, and security. Thus far, we have not received any answer from the Israeli side. When asked if the Palestinians' position was similar to those presented during talks with Olmert, Arakat replied, "It's more than that. I cannot go into detail of what exactly was proposed, but Mahmoud Abbas offered more in these documents than what he proposed to Olmert in the past. Mahmoud Abbas took bigger steps to reach peace." Anahad Ashrari, a Palestinian lawmaker and member of the Palestinian Authority Central Committee, said the United States, in Obama's letter to the Palestinians, threatened to downgrade or even sever ties with the Palestinians. Another Arab language newspaper, Al-Hat, reported that Obama has sent a special communication to Abbas last month that said Washington would not work to extend the Israeli construction freeze in West Bank settlements if the Palestinian leader continued to oppose direct negotiations. According to the report, Obama made clear to Abbas that the United States would reject any Palestinians' efforts to appeal to the Security Council if direct talks failed. During an Arab League meeting in Cairo on Thursday, Abbas said he had been subject to intense pressure to agree to direct talks. Arakat confirmed that many Arab leaders sought to persuade the Palestinian leader to reconsider his position, but he denied any suggestion that Washington had threatened the Palestinians. And so part of what the Palestinian perspective is, it is not just to get back the lands based upon 67 borders, but in doing so they want to humiliate Israel. And so now they're in a position where they can seriously negotiate about the 67 borders if they've presented their own peace offer. But they're not able to at the same time have the humiliation, the degree of the humiliation that they would like to present. And that humiliation, I believe, is that demand that Israel must agree before the talks to return to pre-67 borders. And before the talks, they must agree to extend the freeze on settlement, construction in the West Bank, and in East Jerusalem. So I believe we are at crunch time regarding this process, that something has to give in the next several weeks, in the next month. Either they're going to have direct talks, or it's going to blow up. If they do have direct talks, there now that pressure that's on the Palestinians is going to come upon Israel, especially since the Palestinians have made a peace offer. that has been presented to George Mitchell and Obama wants a peace deal done before the November elections. So the next month or two is very significant as we watch this whole process. Now I'm going to go on and share with you some information regarding the Iranian situation. And as a result of the UN Security Council resolution to put a fourth round of sanctions on Iran, that Russia was going to provide Iran with S-300 anti-aircraft missile systems. But they have delayed in giving those anti-aircraft missile systems to Iran. This article says that Iran now has obtained from another country four S-300 anti-aircraft missile systems. And this will make it more difficult, not impossible, but more difficult for the United States to launch an air attack against Iran if they got this anti-aircraft missile system in place. This article is from the London Sunday Telegraph. The headline is, Iran claims to have smuggled anti-aircraft missile systems into its country. Iran claimed it has smuggled four S-300 anti-aircraft missile systems with a 90-mile range in defiance of UN sanction that prompted a Russian ban on selling the sophisticated defense system to Iran. The article reads, U.S. and British officials responded with delight when Russia unexpectedly pulled out of a deal to sell to Iran after the UN passed sanctions, including an arms embargo on the Islamic State in June. But Iran now claims it received two S-300s from Belarus and two others from another unspecified source. If the news is confirmed, the threat posed by the system would be a serious deterrent to military planners contemplating a strike on Iran's nuclear program. The S-300 is capable of shooting down aircraft, cruise missiles, and ballistic missile warheads at ranges of more than 90 miles and at altitudes of about 90,000 feet. Next article is from Haaretz, August 3rd, and President Obama has announced that he's going to reduce the number of combat troops in Iraq to 50,000 by the end of August, which ironically he's calling a reduction to 50,000 ending operations in Iraq. There is now concern that when we pull back, because Iraq does not yet have a functioning government, that Iraq will still be unstable, and an unstable Iraq is a threat to Saudi Arabia because Iran is interested in building a relationship with the new Iraqi regime. So that's what this article is explaining. August the 3rd from Haaretz. The headline is, Will the United States withdrawal from Iraq threaten Saudi Arabia and Israel? Punctuality, the article reads, is a requirement that annoys every soldier. Diplomats and politicians generally know how to avoid being on time. But with U.S. President Barack Obama's falling in public opinion polls, with the war in Afghanistan changing directions every 3 to 4 months and no end in sight, and with congressional elections approaching in November, Obama said to his supporters, I'm sticking to the schedule. The plan to reduce the number of combat troops in Iraq to 50,000 by the end of August, reaffirmed by Obama on Monday, is not a full retreat, but it is worrying, mostly due to the fact that in Iraq, there is still no government 5 months after elections were held. Iraqi security forces have certainly improved, the number of daily attacks is falling, and the war claims only 50 people per week compared to hundreds only a few years ago. Yet in July, there was a surge of deaths with more than 500 people killed. But the number of attacks is just one measure of the situation that the U.S. is leaving behind. With the absence of an agreed-upon government and with political rivals threatening the situation, it could deteriorate into renewed civil war. The political vacuum gives Iran space to interfere in Iraq's affairs. Iran wants there to be a prime minister in Iraq who will be an Iranian ally and follow Iranian orders. Iran prefers incumbent Shiite Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki over Iyad Alawi, a secular Shiite who is friendly with the United States and is in close contact with the CIA. Less than 2 weeks ago, Alawi met in Damascus with al-Sadr, the separatist Shiite leader who lives in Iran, in order to try to build a coalition. The attempt failed, and other Shiite leaders opposed Alawi being appointed prime minister, despite the fact that Alawi narrowly won the elections by one seat. In Iraq, without an authority able to assume the task that had been carried out by the departing American forces, would threaten Saudi Arabia and Jordan due to the possibility of Iraq joining the pro-Iran axis with Syria and Turkey and leaving the pro-Western spheres of the Arab world behind. Iran is already the main trading partner with Iraq, with the volume of trade between the two nations expected to reach $10 billion this year. Iran also has consulates in the Kurdish region of northern Iraq and has direct access to Iraqi military units. Israel also should be concerned about the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq before the establishment of a political structure that ensures a responsible government. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had shared his worries with U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates about the emergence of a new Eastern Front, which may become the next threat. So, ironically, a withdrawal from Iraq could increase the odds of war with Iran, because Saudi Arabia will feel threatened by Iraq if Iraq is led by the leader who is friendly or tends to look to be friendly to Iran. And, of course, that would be al-Maliki. And so we need to keep an eye on that. Now, the last article I have to share with you is August the 4th. From Infowars.com, and this is an article telling about the International Monetary Fund's goal to establish a global currency, and an article they wrote about it and the way to get there. And right now they're calling the planned upon global currency the Bancor. So the article reads, a newly published International Monetary Fund strategy document calls for the implementation of a global currency called the Bancor to stabilize the international monetary system while acknowledging that only a monumental shift toward acceptance of globalism will make it possible in the short term. So what the International Monetary Fund is saying is, in the short term, we don't see this happening because the nations aren't going to willingly want to accept a global currency. It goes on to say, the International Monetary Fund blueprint authored by Riza Moghaddam, director of the International Monetary Fund Strategy, Policy, and Review Department, has stayed under the radar for 3 months. However, an article on the Financial Times blog Alphaville, entitled International Monetary Fund Blueprint for a Global Currency, yes, really, today highlights the document and the clear strategy of the global financial body. In the eyes of the International Monetary Fund, at least, the best way to ensure the stability of the international monetary system is actually by launching a global currency, Isabella Kaminska notes. And that, the IMF says, is largely because sovereigns, that's independent nations, as they stand, the IMF says, cannot be trusted to redistribute surplus reserves. In other words, rich countries give money to poor countries. Or battle the deficits. A chart with the document innocuously titled Reserve Accumulation and International Monetary Fund Stability presents a stepping stone system toward a full-fledged global currency. Beginning with a vague recommendation for voluntary policy adjustments to be adopted by individual nations, the chart moves through more and more draconian economic policies toward a long-term endgame of a global currency. The chart also plots potential resistance to each stepping stone from independent nations, with a spike in the short term, followed by a lull, and then a general rise as the move toward a global currency progresses over time. The IMF's road to a global currency hinges on a wider use of and eventual implementation of an international monetary system based on special drawing rights, or SDRs, the IMF synthetic paper currency. Once an SDR-based system is in place, the IMF envisions just one final step to the launch of a new global currency. The document even gives the global currency a name, the Bancor, after John Maynard Keynes proposed but never implemented World Currency Unit of Clearing. The following section of the IMF document highlights this, and this is section 48. From SDRs to Bancor. A limitation of the SDR, as discussed previously, is that it is not a currency. Both the SDR and SDR-denominated instruments need to be converted eventually to a paper currency for most payments or interventions in foreign exchange markets, which adds to cumbersome use in transactions. And though an SDR-based system would move away from a dominant national currency, the SDR's value remains heavily linked to the conditions and performance of the major component countries. Now, SDRs is a basket of, I don't know, four or five currencies. So what that's saying is those currencies determine the value of the SDR. And they want to get away from that to a true global currency. A more ambitious reform option would be to build on the previous ideas and develop over time a global currency. Called, for example, Bancor, in honor of Keynes, such a currency would be used as a medium of exchange and outside money, in contrast to the SDRs, which remain an inside money. The document concludes that without a catalyst to create a sudden glamour for globalism, the implementation of the global currency would take time. Let's translate that into common understanding. The document concludes that without a catalyst to create a sudden glamour for globalism, what would be a catalyst to create a sudden glamour for globalism? The collapse of the U.S. dollar? Or World War III. So what they're saying is, without a catalyst, without the collapse of, say, the U.S. dollar, which is serving as a world reserve currency now, in essence, because oil is traded in dollars, and without a crisis where the nations would say, we need globalism, then a global currency will take time to be accepted and to be implemented. It is understood that some of the ideas discussed are unlikely to materialize in the foreseeable future without a catalyst, absent a dramatic shift in appetite for international cooperation. The IMF first touted the possibility of a new global currency in March of last year. The issue was then debated at the G20 summit in London just days later. A clause in point 19 of the communique issued by the G20 leaders led to analysts describing the dawn of a revolution in the global financial order. We've agreed to support a general SDR allocation, which will inject $250 billion into the world economy and increase global liquidity, the clause stated. In effect, the G20 leaders have activated the IMF's power to create money and begin global quantitative easing. That means printing money. In doing so, they are putting a de facto world currency into play. It is outside the control of any sovereign body. Conspiracy theorists will love it, Ambrose Evans Pritchard of the London Telegraph wrote in reporting about the G20 meeting. The world is a step closer to a global currency backed by a global central bank running monetary policy for all humanity, he added. The same conclusion was drawn by the Washington Post Anthony Falalo, who described how the IMF is on course to be transformed into a veritable United Nations for the global economy. The move has also been endorsed separately by the World Bank and the United Nations. The head of the International Monetary Fund, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, has repeated the call for a global currency over SDRs multiple times. The introduction of a new global currency and taxation system, that's the purpose of the carbon tax, with an overarching regulatory body is the key cornerstone in the move toward global government, centralized control, and more power being concentrated into fewer unaccountable hands. So we have this being crunch time for the peace process, and summarizing this week's articles, that the Palestinians have presented the United States with their own peace offer that Israel won't be able to respond to unless there's direct talks. Israel said they want direct talks. The United States says they want direct talks. The European Union says they want direct talks. Saudi Arabia has said they want direct talks. Mahmoud Abbas wants to not back down from his original position that he wants Israel to agree that a state will be based upon pre-67 borders and an ending to settlement construction in the West Bank and East Jerusalem and the continuation of no more building before he will enter into those direct talks. President Obama, of course, can't sell that and make it look like he's being reasonable. So now he's trying to force the Palestinians to have direct talks so that I believe he can force Israel to accept a Palestinian state. And so as for now, the Palestinians are missing an opportunity to miss an opportunity, but Obama is not going to back down very easily because I believe he wants some type of an agreement made by the November elections so that he can say that he's worked to solve a major problem in the world. Meanwhile, we've had border clashes in Israel with Lebanon. We've had the last few months the incidents with the Gaza flotilla ships wanting to come in, and the whole area is completely armed that any day a war could start. Any day there could be a bombing of Iran. But if you look at this logistically, and of course this is my opinion again, that if a peace agreement is a possibility to be on the horizon, perhaps as Obama would like in the next couple of months, they wouldn't want to go to war now because that's got to delay a peace agreement. So I think they're gonna. The strategy is to try to work hard to try to get a peace agreement in the next, actually through the end of October. So we're actually talking the next 2.5 months. And then after the November elections, perhaps logically, I'm looking at this logically, maybe somewhere from November to February, that they would maybe looking to bomb Iran and to have a collapse of the U.S. dollar. And if there's a war and a collapse of the dollar, then they can move and get the nations to agree to a global currency, which the IMF is now openly calling for and have written a paper to lay out the plans to get there. And they said that unless there is basically a global crisis, that it's going to take longer rather than a shorter period of time. And I don't think that they want to be patient. So these are very critical times, and that's why for those who are watching the prophecies in current events, this is a very critical period to stay updated regarding these things that are happening. That's why we're doing the 5-minute update for you, why we are being watchmen on the walls. For those of you who weren't aware, the reason why we haven't given a 5-minute update since toward the end of June is I was on a 5-6 week European tour teaching the Hebrew roots of Christianity in Belgium, in the Netherlands, in Switzerland, France, Germany, and Poland. And it was a real blessed trip, and we was able to sow many seeds in those countries. And so, as the saying goes, it only takes a spark to get a fire going. And so we hope that by having meetings in these countries, that we're helping to get the word spread of our Hebrew roots in Europe. And so we thank the God of Israel for making that possible. One other thing I'd like to announce is we are going to a fall schedule regarding the Pal Talk room for those who listen in live. And beginning on August the 21st, which is only 2 weeks from now, the Beit Yaakov room is going to be opening at 5 p.m. That's the plan right now. 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time rather than in the morning at 10:45. This will give an opportunity for those, especially on the West Coast, to be able to tune in a little bit more conveniently. Otherwise, in order for them to participate live in the room, they have to be up at 7:30 in the morning logged in. And so this will give an opportunity for more people in the United States to have a more convenient opportunity to participate and hear the 5-minute update live and the weekly teachings that are given through the Pal Talk room of Hebraic Heritage Ministries and the Yeshiva program. And so I pray that this week's 5-minute update has been a blessing to you. I'd like to mention that next weekend I'll be at a conference in Chicago, and so I don't know whether I'm able to do a 5-minute update next week, but if it is possible, I will try to do one. The conference starts on Thursday. That's when I'm going to Chicago. And so until we see you and do it again, Shalom, and Yeshua the Messiah, Amen.